Welcome to a Cult of Personality podcast. I'm honored to welcome back to the program Taw Allen Greenfield. Thank you so much for joining us again.
I'm delighted to be here. It's a program that I always seem, it seems to bring out of me some of the best ideas that I may have in my poor brain. So it's delightful to be here.
Oh, thank you very much. And for people who are listening and are not familiar, one of your websites can be found at talsirhasareem.livejournal.com, which is your live journal site, and I will link your main website, Assembly of the Knowledge and Wisdom of Solomon, as well as Wikipedia and the previous appearances that you've had. So we've discussed in some detail, you know, your spiritual path and history in regards to the occult, metaphysics, the paranormal. And tonight, what we wanted to talk about primarily, in addition to some other subjects, is this idea of censorship in the modern age, right now, that we live in today. You had written a book that you entitled Inquisition in 21st Century America. You published this book, and since that time, it's gotten pulled and it's no longer available for sale. Is that correct?
At least with the official publisher, that is correct. I recall that when we first started to talk about doing this program about a month ago, the idea was to discuss my two new books, Victorian Fire, which I think we'll discuss later, and Inquisition in the 21st Century, which is my version, my documentation of my withdrawal from the Ordo Templi Orientis, the OTO. And it's not a sour grapes book. It's my version of things, which I think here in America we kind of like to have, you know, access to people's differing versions of what goes on. But some strings were apparently pulled. I have found out who. I'm not prepared to reveal that publicly as yet, as I want to know whether it was on direct orders from above or whether it was on this person's own initiative. But a high-ranking official complained that there were violations of copyright, which in my opinion there are none, nor was that the reason for it in my opinion. And the print-on-demand service, I generally go to publishers that have standard contracts, and this time, because it was essentially just a quickie monograph to give my a summary of my side of the story of what I regarded as a ghastly and unjust Inquisition, which is literally the name for it. I mean, I'm not being flamboyant there. The office involved is called Grand Inquisitor Commander, and it is, in fact, an Inquisition. I thought that was a fairly novel thing to be talking about in the 21st century in the United States or anywhere else in the world, except maybe in fundamentalist Islamist countries or something. I guess that sort of thing happens, or the equivalent. But a major official of the body that had a great deal to do with expelling me from that organization applied a certain amount of pressure to the print-on-demand service, and they pulled it down. And I have not been able to get them to put it back up. I've never, in this particular case, cared very much. I mean, I don't ever mind making money, but I never cared about, you know, the money involved. That was just sort of automatically to get them to do anything. They, you know, they want their cut, therefore there's a certain price on it. So I immediately received a lot of offers from varying people, some in countries where really the organization or its officials really can't touch legally or otherwise, and to republish, and others who have offered to do things as diverse as put it up on the what do they call it? The undernet, the news groups, Usenet. And it's out there somewhere on Usenet. And I have just been apprised of the fact that apparently someone has put it up, and I assure you it was not me since I'd never even heard of them, something called Pirates, let's see, what do they call themselves?
The Pirate Bay
organization, and so it's out there for free for nothing, and at the same time, as long as I can, given that it takes my poor DSL about 2 minutes to transmit the text, I will send a copy to anyone who writes me at bishop17@mindspring.com free for nothing. If they care to make a donation, they can do it through my PayPal portal. I'm always glad to receive something for it, because I don't even remember what they were charging for it, nor do I care at this point. They don't have to send a penny, but I'll be glad to send it to them for nothing, and if they care to send an Inquisition donation, I'll take it.
Wow.
Otherwise, they can go to Pirates Bay. It's free there. It's just I don't know that much about, you know. I have not seen it, so I don't know whether it's has all of the pictures and setting and so forth, that the documentation that is so important in the original.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I think in order to sort of set the stage and talk about this book and its subsequent censoring, if we could sort of go back in time just a bit to the long history that you had with this organization, the OTO, or this magical order of antiquity, as they've been referred to in the past.
Or the antiquated order, I say sometimes when I'm being somewhat more sarcastic.
that's a good one.
I'm not sure sarcastic and inaccurate are necessarily on the same plane. I think it's probably quite antiquated, or this sort of thing would not happen. I mean, you know, you when you kick people when they're down, I mean, I'm not personally down, but, you know, they threw me out of the organization after what I consider to be non-due process, very irregular process. That's what the book is about. And then I'm no longer, you know, in any way attached to them. Then they go after my book, telling my side of the story, and somebody said, oh, you're just being whiny, and I actually, the reason I published it isn't because of my situation. I'm doing just fine with the congregational illuminism, which is what I've been advocating for a long time. That is, organizing from the bottom up rather than the top down. In fact, I'm doing better now than I was doing when I was active in the OTO, but the reality of the situation is that it's difficult for me to recapture how on earth I got involved. All I can say is I was already 20 years an occultist at the time I got involved. 10 years of practicing over 10 years of practicing ceremonial magician, and in the early 1980s, the local OTO body master, who was the highest ranking person I knew in the OTO at that time, asked me to help him organize the Gnostic Catholic Church in Atlanta. And I said, well, I actually have a perfectly good religion of my own. I'm a lifelong Reformed Jew, and that's what I do. And he said, well, it's not a religion. And he goes into this, you know, that it's basically a mystery play and a spiritual, sort of like yoga in a sense, and sort of like an initiation without taking initiation, and I accepted that. And for 3 years I hung around, but when I became aware that this organization was had a leader appointed for life, and that they had absolute authority, I was I'm a very free spirit. I was very uncomfortable with that notion, but eventually they recognized me as having attained to, and again, I consider this more a quasi-Masonic title than a religious title, but a bishop within the greater Gnostic community, and they recognized me as a bishop within the OTO, and there I was in that unique position of not being an initiate member of the OTO, but being an ecclesiastical member according to their corporate laws at that time, that I decided to go ahead and take the plunge and take initiation. And I spent the better part of 20 years as a member in good standing, eventually ranking member in good standing, right up until they threw me out. I mean, within it went from one to the other within the space of weeks, and is based, I think, entirely on the which if you have my website, the statement on the OTO is a tough public statement on the problems of the OTO, and it does call on reform in the upper leadership, but there's no, you know, ill language in it or personal attacks or anything of that sort. It basically is an analysis of corporate leadership and saying the people who've been in for the last 20 years have done a bad job, they should step down and let others handle it, without any condemnation of them as persons. And even after that, there was nothing in the way of recriminations or warnings to take it down or anything of that sort. They talked very much about path of mediation, but I didn't have, I was really even surprised that I, not so much as a comment. I think it was just lack of interest, you know, and in the meantime, since I had, could not serve as, not in good conscience, serve under that kind of leadership in administrative offices. I stepped down from my administrative offices, but no, I did not resign from the organization or the initiatory ranks that had been conferred on me. They're kind of hard to step down from. I mean, more or less impossible, in my opinion. But after that, for the nearly 10 years of work I'd done as Secretary for Correspondence, which basically means I was the first contact person for people all over the United States that wrote in looking for information, and other positions of a similar sort, including the Most Wise Sovereign of Rose Croix Chapter, a very important responsibility in the OTO, I received citations of commendation from them after publication of this statement on the OTO, a month after, and then a month after that. And 2 months after that, in May of that year, I guess that was 2005 maybe, 2006, I'm not sure, I'd have to check back. I had to do what's known as a defense of a candidate for the Knight of the East and West degree with personal defense to the U.S. Grand Master of the organization. And we had back and forth about that. My candidate was approved. I was told to go ahead and perform the initiation, which is a high-level initiation. Only a handful of people are even allowed to do initiations at that level. And at no time was there any recrimination for the statement on the OTO. And 2 months later, all of a sudden, there's I'm asked to resign from the organization, which I refused to do. And immediately, I mean, within 8 days, and I even did a piece called 8 Days Last Summer, which was now summer before last. Within 8 days, I went from being an honored senior member to being suspended and on trial for my membership, so-called. And actually, it was an inquisition for real. I mean, it went on for a year. They apparently had to work their way up to doing something about it. And when they did, circumstances were such they held it as far away from my location as they possibly could and still be within the jurisdiction of U.S. Grand Lodge, thus assuring that I couldn't be there. And they never did inform me of when and where it was. So, you know, it was it gave the appearance. I don't even know why they bothered. I mean, they do have the right to simply expel someone. It gave the appearance of being due process, but it was under rules that came into being after after the fact, that is, after my statement, and I really never got a chance to defend myself. So the book was essentially my defense, was my perspective on the situation for those people who are members, and as a warning to those people who are not or who might at some point come into confrontation with the organization, that there ain't no justice there. And that is, you know, everyone is entitled to a different opinion, but that is my sincere belief, and I cite in the book many reasons for believing so. But, of course, you can't get the commercial edition because it got pulled down by someone. A ranking official, I might add, who had a big role in the Inquisition itself.
This is... it's amazing. So you went from, as you said, an honored and appreciated high-ranking member, and then days later, everything had changed. And it's interesting to note, as you did, that it was quite some time after putting up the statement about the OTO that this occurred.
Oh, not only was it after that, but it was after I had, again, the grand officers of U.S. Grand Lodge had twice given me, in the interim period, written citations, which I have posted on my site, just not for personal aggrandizement, but just to document that I was in really good standing after this statement was put up. I mean, these are commendations for a job well done as late as I recall, February and March of that year, the same year that they threw me out. And then, of course, to have March and April of that year. So that was, you know, well after publication. And then in May of last year, just before they came down on me, I had all of this interaction with the U.S. Grand Master, and it wasn't even mentioned. I mean, all he would have had to have done would be to say, I have objections to this, and you need to decide whether you want to be a member or pull this down, and then I would have decided what to do. I probably would have said, you know, I'm for free speech a lot more than I'm for membership in the OTO, but at least I should have been given the opportunity to do that, in my opinion. But there was nothing. There was nothing. It was all of a sudden, and to this day, I don't know exactly what happened in July of 2006, I guess it was. All I know is that I went from being one of their fair-haired boys, well, a little elderly for a boy, but a 20-year, much-honored member to being scurrilous. And there are many, many, many people took my side, and it's still an ongoing thing, but also there are people who I thought were friends who won't even speak to me. And I don't know. As near as I can tell, they were not mad about the statement because they said nothing about that. Some of them were even local. It has to have been because they were brown-nosing and the leadership suddenly, you know, turned savage on me. Well, savage may be an excessive term. Let's just say turned against me.
Now, if we assume that they were aware, knowledgeable about what you had written in this statement, which I think is a safe assumption.
I would, if not, then I would fault them for not reading their own major officials' websites. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that. As I said, I spoke with the Grand Master in the interim. And I had a long, frank discussion with him as to why. At the same time, I put up the statement. I stepped down, you know, during the same week from the administrative positions I'd held, stating that I had serious problems with the present leadership. Now, if that didn't send them running to my site to see what it was my problems were, I don't know what it would take. But I did all of this absolutely honorably and by the book, so to speak. They were apparently not satisfied that I had stepped down from administrative jobs. They wanted me out. But not then. It was 5 months later, and on a dime, you know, no path of mediation, no attempt to discuss it or speak about it privately, and it would not have been a shock if it had happened as when I posted this, but 5 months later, out of nowhere, that was a shock. And then, of course, going all the way down to just very recently, since we first spoke about doing this program, a book, I'm no longer a member of that organization, that I wrote to give my side of the story because of what they regard or say they regard as infringement of copyright, which is very, very debatable. It's a fair use, brief quotations, that sort of thing, to document what I say as being true. If I had not made those brief quotations, I'm sure the criticism would have been, oh, he's making all of this up. So, you know, I was very careful in my, I think it satisfies the exact chapter and verse of what fair use is in talking about copyrights, the diversion, what they wanted to do, since they also threw out or forced out a number of other people at almost exactly the same moment as me, I think was a determined effort, maybe still ongoing, to suppress any kind of serious dissent in the organization. And that scares me. Scares me as a person, scares me as an American. It just doesn't seem right.
No, not a bit. Now, I'm curious whether or not, or sort of what your opinion is regarding this. It seems to me, based on what you said, that from the moment you put the statement out there and it, you know, made your doubts known, that a decision was more or less made, and you were kept around to sort of be monitored and make sure of what you were up to.
I'll tell you something odd. That's the first time I've heard that theory. Now, that's interesting, too. Again, I don't know exactly what happened. I'll give you my best guess if you want, but I don't know exactly what happened. But if that's true, you know, if they had already decided, then they were better than I think they are at keeping quiet about it. And, indeed, I really was, you know, working hard for the work as I always had been. But then I'm working hard for the great work now, you know. I mean, that's not something they really have say over. They may think they do, or they may think they have a monopoly on truth, but last I heard, that's a presumption that we confine to Islamists and other fanatics, and I hope they don't have an attitude that they are the truth, the light, the way, because one of my big selling points when I was working for them and recruiting for them was, this is a truth, a light, a way, not the truth, the light, and the way. And who knows what happened. I mean, I can, you know, briefly summarize what I said in my statement. Anyone can read it, but you can decide for yourself whether it's inflammatory or personally critical, or whether it's just what I consider it to be and what I intended it to be, which is a tough but fair corporate assessment of the corporation, the OTO, Inc., as it has developed under the present upper management.
Yeah, that's a very interesting sort of, I guess, in some ways, it obviously viewed by some as a conflicting ideas, this the freedom of speech, being able to say what you think and believe, without fear of being censored or having some sort of reprisal. for it, versus this idea of silence and keeping things in house and dealing with things internally. Obviously, the freedom to say what you want and what you believe is really paramount. I think, you know, obviously I agree with that, or I wouldn't be doing this myself.
Oh, exactly. But not only that, it's puzzling because it's codified in the OTO. I mean, I still have enough respect for their privacy that I'm not going to go into the details of the initiations, but very early on, Liber Oz, which is a basic document of the entire polemic movement, and certainly a basic document of the OTO, one that one raises one's right hand and pledges with the master of the event in question, pledges themselves to, is the freedom to write what you will. And they say, well, not without consequences. Well, then you're just getting back to, you can write what you will in China, but you'll wind up, if you're lucky, in the slammer if it's something particularly critical of the government. So that obviously it means something more than that. It means that at least artistic freedom is non-negotiable. And I think that's also something in the U.S. Constitution. It probably doesn't include the right to yell fire in a crowded theater and a few other just common sense things, but none of this was that. It was a scholarly critique. And if I'm not allowed to do that, no one else is allowed to do that. And it's very interesting that the very thing that someone saw to it was no longer available, starts out the very first page, the famous quotation that's attributed to Pastor Martin Niemöller, who I think died in a concentration camp after he had been pro-Nazi for a long time, but he, towards the end of his life, changed his view as he saw things. And if I may, let me quote that. It's very brief, and it's well known, but it's worth quoting here because I think it applies. He said, "When the Nazis came for the communists, I remained silent. I was not a communist. When they locked up the social democrats, I remained silent. I was not a social democrat. When they came for the trade unionists, I did not speak out. I was not a trade unionist. When they came for the Jews, I remained silent. I wasn't a Jew. When they came for me, there was no one left to speak out." So I draw from that that anyone could wind up on the wrong end of this, even those who are so careful to praise the leadership and brown nose their way to the top. All they have to do is make one really serious slip, and apparently these slips can be after the fact, because as near as I can tell, mine was something that they created a rule so that it was wrong after I did it, because my previous service had to be answered for, which was nothing but, I won't say nothing but praise, but certainly overwhelmingly predominantly praise, and I don't think they would even have the temerity to say that it was otherwise up until that point. And apparently they never asked themselves the question, well, why did he change his view? And it's because I saw the organization headed in the wrong direction and was trying to save it. At this point, though, after what I've seen in the last year with the Inquisition and with the pressure to remove the book from circulation and a lot of really brutal personal comments, I've gone from that position to I wouldn't recommend membership in this organization to anyone. It's headed in what I consider to be a dangerous direction.
That really says it all right there. And that quote that you read sort of is, I think, a good point to sort of pull back and look at this in the larger context. Because, you know, I have to wonder when I see what's going on around me. This seems to be a trend in many different places, limiting of free speech, sort of attacking people who don't follow what is considered to be the accepted normal or average viewpoint. What are your thoughts on that? And in the times we live in now, is this something that you feel is a problem in a sort of a larger context?
I wouldn't be the first person to point out a fairly good parallel with the post 9/11 security in the Bush administration, and I think there is an element of that. And I think that it depends on where you're looking and when. Yes, we are entering a period of history in which intolerance and fanaticism seem to be once again rearing its ugly head in diverse forms around the world. There is an alarming trend in Russia, which has had an opportunity to move away from the kind of Stalinist past that it had to be a much more open society. There's a trend away from that towards essentially a one-party government that controls the media and thus controls essentially elections. There is certainly a trend in this country, that is in the United States, in the name of homeland security, of not securing either the homeland or making it more secure. That was kind of circular, but I think you get my point. It's definitely a worldwide trend. I would point out that in the case of this particular organization, and again, just in my opinion, my impression, but not uninformed impression, it's accelerated goes considerably beyond those examples that I've just cited. I think a comparable thing would be your program gets pulled. The internet is under the direct control of the state, and things that they don't want on are not on. That isn't happening, but that is what happened to my book on that very subject. Pastor Niemöller is not read by everyone, but he certainly won't be read in my book. First page that you open it up to has that quotation, only it isn't there anymore because someone didn't want it to be. And I think that the level and the speed with which this organization has gone from a bastion of freedom to a very conservative, that's probably the wrong term to use. Let's just say very reactionary organization that has circled the wagons and has a very defensive and hostile posture towards the outside world, as far as I can see, is more extreme than what we're seeing here. The comparable thing would be some of the things that are going on in the Islamic world, and that is distressing. It may be an omen of things to come, however, in society. It may be. I always had hoped that it was an organization that would be ahead of its times when I thought that it was a bastion of freedom. Now I'm worried that it may be in the vanguard of a future that is tyrannical, and that, of course, is something that I, at any level in society, would feel compelled to speak out about. But in something that I worked for 20 years, I would think, morally obligated to speak out on it. Especially since my job was recruiting people. Some karma to work there, I think. I think there's a lesson in this also. It may not be fully developed yet. I mean, I have some reason to believe that legitimate publisher in a, let's just say, in a third world country that is not subject to the jurisdiction that would be subject to these pressures may come out with a, quote, legitimate, unquote, edition of this. But as long as it is being distributed through these various routes, Pirates Bay or through me, the reality of it is, and I hesitate to say this, it's embarrassing, but it may make a point. At the time that they, whoever they may be, saw to it that this was pulled, it had sold exactly 8 copies. Since that time, I have had dozens of requests, really, I would say, you know, far more than I would have expected, considering this is manually done and it takes me about 2 minutes to upload to people the PDF version of it, which I do free. You know, I say if you care to make a contribution, I give them a way to do that through my PayPal portal. But, you know, if they do, they do. If they don't, they don't. Some do, some don't. That's fine. It's free. And with these other ways of getting it free of charge, far more people are giving it attention than would have had they just left it alone. Maybe there's something to be learned from that. My post on my LiveJournal concerning the removal of the book from circulation drew the largest number of comments, I believe, of any entry that I've made in the 3 or 4 years that I have been on LiveJournal. So, and of course, it has been commented on in other places as well, so it created a furor. The same was true, I think, of the statement on the OTO. If they had simply left it alone, it would not have become a cause celeb. But you start monkeying with people's right to hear what people have to say, right or wrong, their sincere opinions, then people are going to want to hear it. That has been the rule of thumb since the Declaration of Independence, if not before. And I think it's an awful strategy on their part and has done nothing but give more people a chance to peruse and decide for themselves on my side of the picture of what happened to me when the OTO decided I was not good material for their organization.
Before we, you know, leave this topic, I just want to make sure that, you know, I allowed you a chance to sort of say everything that you wanted to in terms of the book and the censorship and the whole situation, which is just outrageous.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that, you know, we could go into the minutia for hours about the very material that is in the book, but I think it will suffice to say, if you want more details of it, get the book or you know, through one of the diverse routes, or twirl through my LiveJournal, or go, you know, if you want to see the original statement and see what, quote, awful, unquote, things I had to say and see whether it was intemperate or not, go to my website, and it's called A Statement on the Ordo Templi Orientis, and see if you find it disagreeable or out of line, that's fine. If you find it to be something that is of substance, that's fine. And I guess to conclude, I would say that I was already beginning to believe that organizing from the bottom up rather than the top down, that is, local organizations with local leadership and networking with other organizations, which I call congregational Illuminism, seems like a better deal and probably more suited to a happier future, and that's where a lot of my energy is today. And as long as I'm around, that's where it will continue to be. And I'm not alone in this. Over the last year and a half, however long it's been, there are many things that have appeared on my LiveJournal, but I've received many letters in confidence that I've never released from people in and out of the OTO, low and quite high, expressing similar thoughts on the subject. So Perhaps we will have some modest effect in making change, not within the OTO. I think that's impossible, but on a broader basis, that is the occult community as a whole.
Yeah, let us hope so. Absolutely. So thank you very much for that. And with that, I'd like to sort of transition into talking about your other new book, Victorian Fire, which concerns a history of sex magic.
Well,
is that correct?
Yes, no. My magnum opus, if I can call it that, on sexual magic is a little book that is now out of print called True Quest for the Holy Grail, and it brings it right up to, up to modern times. What I did not do was cover the origins of sexual magic, which I consider so important. I think it is the key to all forms of magical work and is the most direct route. And in Victorian Fire, I concentrate on what were the secret documents of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light and the Brotherhood of Eulis in the 19th century. And during the Victorian era, there was a remarkable upsurge of interest in sexual magic, but of course it was somewhat more muted. Those were times where you really couldn't put out a book called Victorian Fire. It probably would have wound up in the fire, and that I have had no trouble with. The material is a little quaint. I have the two key pieces that I think the most important person in the development of sexual magic in the West that I know of, Dr. Pascal Beverly Randolph, wrote these for the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light and Brotherhood of Eulis, and they were the secret texts of that organization. And they are included, and I also include a distorted version of it from a later writer to show how it could be corrupted, and introduce it at some length and give some perspective on how these organizations come forward from even earlier sources in the 18th century. And I think it is a good introduction to what sexual magic was like before the sexual revolution and before modern times, where the subject is a little bit less taboo, at least so far as its most popular forms are concerned. And it has always bothered me that P.B. Randolph is less recognized than he should be, and I've often thought that given the fact that he was an exponent of sexual magic in the 19th century and was an Afro-American, probably had a lot to do with his not being mentioned in a lot of texts of that period, because it was just pure racism. And I have done what I can to redress that, and I'm kind of proud of my efforts in that direction. Mm. Now, I should say, in fairness, that I don't distribute this book at all myself. It's distributed by Lulu, and you have to go to Lulu's Marketplace, which is easy enough to find on the internet, and just it's in the subject sex and relationships, and it's called Victorian Fire, The Origins of Sexual Magic, and you can buy it either as a download or as a paperback book. If you get the paperback, it has a really cool cover.
Oh, that's very nice, yeah. Now, for people who are listening who aren't already aware, would you mind just talking a little bit more about P.B. Randolph and some of his work? I think, as you mentioned, he's a very important figure, and you've written quite a bit about
him. There's when I first got involved in the magical universe, you would not even find his name anywhere, even though he had been a very prominent person. Randolph, when a young man in the 1840s, hit on some secret materials from Eastern sources. He also seems to have had a great deal to do with the early spiritualist movement and trans-channeling. And trans-channeling, I think, is probably the origin of a lot of his ideas. He became very prominent, both as a medium, using a what's called a bot, a black mirror, which I've also worked with, and scrying in the black mirror. It's sort of like scrying in a crystal, but it's a unique, if poisonous, formula to make an unauthentic black mirror, and it has a certain ambiance about it that I've never found in anything else. It's almost like having a television into otherwhere, you know.
I know exactly what you mean. I'm looking at one right now.
Don't fall into it. That's the only warning I'll give you. And don't expose it to sunlight. That really can mess it up. Moonlight is fine. But in any case, his early career, you would probably characterize him as a medium, and he was also a physician. He traveled to Europe and the Middle East, and it was at that point that he seems to have gained a great deal of knowledge, some of which he has left us memoirs of that say differing things. The conclusion I reach from that is that he is disguising some of his sources. I have some reason to believe that he knew Eliphas Levi, and that was one of his sources. He certainly knew some of the great mystics in the East, including the very elusive Paulos Medimon when he was visiting in Egypt. He probably knew Madame Blavatsky as well, but she detested him, and probably that was a purely racial thing. In fact, there's an awful quotation that I won't use, so, which is attributed to her when he died, that would be as racist as you could possibly get. But in any case, he also developed a following in both Asia Minor and Africa and in Europe, and influenced a whole generation of magicians all the way up into the Hermetic Brotherhood of Light, which in turn migrated to America. And I would say that all organizations that remain in any way, even theoretically, involved in the magic, the yoga of sex, the magic of sexuality, transforming as a transformative means of magical progression, they owe a direct linear debt to Randolph and to his successors such as Freeman Dowd and others. There are those who completely got it wrong. R. Swinburne Clymer clearly completely misunderstood it, and there are editions of Eulis and other books by Randolph that had all of the good stuff edited out of them because clearly it was embarrassing to them. And there are other organizations that sort of get it right, and there are some that got it right at one time and seem to have lost track of it. It just points out that this is an extremely difficult trend to hold on to and not to veer into something that is either just exploitational on the one hand, or that becomes sort of the Kiwanis Club of magic on the other hand. It's a tough route, but I think looking back at the sources, which I have looked back at before in my book, The Roots of Magic, which has been around for quite some time, but that sort of looks into all the different roots of magic from 1700 to 2000. This concentrates entirely on the 19th century sexual magic, and I think that it probably is something that anyone interested in the fast route to magical development probably would profit from reading. Now, Randolph, at the end of his life, he did not live a long life, and essentially, the Victorian times caught up with him. He, his organization had developed some experimental magical groups that were apparently devoted to sexual gnosis. They were called Rosicrucian rooms in the fashion of the times. They were raided by the police in a number of cities, and Randolph was despondent about that, and shortly thereafter committed suicide. And I think he can be viewed as a kind of a martyr to being well ahead of his time in terms of what you can and can't talk about and what you can and can't advocate. And nevertheless, his works survived, although unpublished, for a very long time, and I'm pleased to bring them into print, and there are a few other people who have been brave enough to do so as well, and I think that that we are recapturing just where these the roots of this tradition are, and can understand it therefore a lot better than we would otherwise.
Yeah, that's definitely makes a big difference. And it's interesting as well how you'd mentioned, you know, there were versions of these works published with, you know, certain sections removed or taken out.
Well,
it's very interesting.
The organization that has done that, Swinburne Climbers Rosicrucian Fraternity, did that early on, and I think there are generations of people who've read what they think are the real books by Randolph, and they are very, very, very edited. And that's unfortunate because it is the most important stuff that gets left out. I don't think it was insincerely done. It was done in the climate of the Victorian and Edwardian period, where that was considered, the sexual stuff was considered distasteful. But nevertheless, of course, it essentially gutted what Randolph was explicitly saying to his students, and it has taken a long time for this material to reappear. Thankfully, that is a lot less true now than, say, even 10 or 15 years ago when this material was virtually unknown.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe you've traced sort of the history of this these practices back even further than this. Is that right?
I have try to link it historically in reverse. That is, start out where we are now in the most advanced cutting edges of the corpus of knowledge of sexual magic in theory and in practice, and go backwards, using that instead of organizational bona fides. You know, organizations come and go, and they tend not to survive their founder, and if they do, they're radically changed. But Martin Starr once pointed out to me that there is a unique trend of thought involved in the authentic magical tradition, that if you can identify the trail of that thought, you can identify the authentic tradition in any period of history. And so I've gone in that reverse order, and I've traced with confidence all the way back to 1700, which is, in the greater scheme of things, not that long. But still, none of that existed before I started delving into it. It was just little pieces here and little pieces there. But I have found, and the further back I go, of course, the less reliable the exact trend is, you know, who did what when, who said what when, because the earlier magical treatises, the authorship is usually attributed to the most famous person, and some of them are attributed to biblical figures and so forth, and you have to do a lot of guesswork based on syntax and little clues here and there as to when and where these works first appeared. Nevertheless, I'm pretty well satisfied that I can give a rough sketch before 1700 going back to ancient Sumer and beyond that to what must be a truly primitive tradition of sexual magic that goes back to shamanic cultures of primordial times, of literally of prehistoric times in the sense that they go back before any kind of written records, but that you can see evidence of in cave paintings that are 15,000 years old. And you can get some clues to it in that there are forms of this particular type of magic in the remaining shamanic nomadic cultures that still survive today. I think it would be a mistake to assume that those today are exactly like those 15,000 years ago in the last ice age, but I think there are enough clues to say that the tradition of using the potent force of sexuality as a means of magical attainment goes back to the earliest times and reaches a certain coherency in ancient Sumer, the origin of which civilization nobody really knows and no one has ever figured out, migrates over into the neighboring Semitic civilizations in Akkad and later in Babylon and so forth, all the way forward to the more sexually explicit versions of the Kabbalistic tradition, which kind of reached its fruition in the Zohorists of the 18th and early 19th centuries, and seems to have had even some influence on kind of off-Masonic organizations more recently. Again, the further back we go, the less specific it's going to become. But if you follow that trail of the basic ideas of sexuality wedded to spirituality, wedded to magical culture, the places that you find that are the links in the authentic tradition, and I'm pretty well satisfied that this goes back to the very dawn of human existence.
The information that you've written about and that you've just sort of shared with us really is quite profound. Especially in terms of this idea of the authentic tradition. I know we've talked about this before at some length, but I find it amazing that, you know, all these things are all tied together so closely, and, you know, that by tracing the ideas, you can sort of take it all the way back to the dawn of civilization.
Where it becomes an identifiable system, that is, that you can find elements today in organizations that are those that are somewhat public and those that are absolutely secret. They do have certain things in common in terms of initiatory processes, consecratory processes, degree systems, and so forth. I think that comes together in Sumer and later in Babylon. And those are degree systems, and I have been working with some of my associates to recapture as much as is possible of that system. We do have, from the rite of Memphis, not referring to Elvis's estate, but referring to the city in ancient Egypt, 97 degrees, and of course there are obvious reasons for thinking that there were originally 360 degrees, which would be a very complex system, but I never thought that any of the people that I work with would capture that in my lifetime. I just hope to, you know, set these things in motion as much as I could, and we'll see where it goes. The thing is, we've had a major breakthrough in just the last couple of months since my dear friend and colleague, Synchronous 23, as she is known, became a bishop on Arabia Mountain and came down with all of these ideas, and it looks like we may actually be able to verify all 360 degrees, which completes a circle, as it were, literally and metaphorically. And it's almost too much for me to take in. I mean, this is not being done by me. I'm sort of following it with trying to keep my mouth closed and keep my composure, but it's major, major league breakthroughs, and we may have a lot more to say over the next couple of years on that. We may actually have the most ancient, coherent system of initiation and consecration pulled together, and then we can do what really needs to be done by anyone who considers himself a scientific illuminist, which I do, which is to verify it or to repudiate it from experience. And the only way to do that is to find out what the degrees are, find out what their properties are purported to be, and test them in practice. And then we will see.
Well, it was been a pleasure again talking with Utah Alan Greenfield. And once again, I would encourage people to get a copy of your book, both books, Victorian Fire as well as Inquisition in 21st Century America, currently only available in electronic format. And again, I'll put up links to your email as well as your website so people can contact you and get information about that. So I appreciate it, and thank you once again.
A real pleasure, and I feel like we've gotten to discuss some of the really important stuff that needs to be out there that otherwise isn't. So thank you so much, and anytime.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. You preach a man, don't tell me. Heaven is under the earth. You are dopey and you don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold, and half a story has never been told. So now we see the light. We gonna stand up for our rights. Come on, get up, stand up. Brothers, stand up for your rights. Come on, get up, stand up, sisters, don't give up the fight. I'm begging you to get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, I said don't give up the fight. Cause you know most people think a great God will come from the skies and take away. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours right here on earth. And now we see the light. We gonna stand up for our rights. Come on, get up, stand up. Don't make them push you around. Stand up for your rights. Come on, brothers, get up, stand up. Be brave now, don't give up the fight. I say get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Don't let them hold you down. Get up, stand up. Don't give up to the fight. Sick and tired of this game of technology. Humbly asking Jesus for his mercy. We know and we understand. Almighty Jah is a living man.